And I'll try to deal with them in the same order that they were raised. So James from Cambridge, yeah? Did Trotsky influence other revolutions? Well, in one way not, because Stalin did quite a good job of liquidating the Trotskyist movement. And what he didn't succeed in liquidating, the so-called Trotskyists themselves did a very good job of finishing off. Unfortunately, when Stalin assassinated Trotsky, which is at a crucial moment, 1940, during the war, when he was beginning to produce remarkable works, very important works, and Trotsky did try to organize a movement called the Fourth International, but it was a small movement, mainly consisting of the remnants, shall we say, of the shattering of the Communist International, the Communist Party. So a lot of them were quite demoralized people, and a lot of them were quite confused people, it must be said. When Stalin beheaded the Fourth International, he knew what he was doing. And unfortunately, the so-called leaders of the Fourth International, shall we say that they were not up to the level of the tasks posed by history. They made all kinds of mistakes. And therefore, the Trotskyist movement itself fell into decline. We would say that it was maintained, basically, by another great Marxist. Unfortunately, he's not with us now, Ted Grant, in Britain, who maintained the genuine position of Trotskyism. I'll come back to Lizzie's question on that in a moment. But what is striking is that Trotsky's theory of the permanent revolution, that was demonstrated to be correct, both negatively and positively, in one country after another. For example, in Cuba, although there wasn't a direct influence of Trotsky, although I'll come back to that in a minute. Che Guevara was influenced by Trotsky's matter. I'll come back to that. I'll give you an interesting insight on that. But when the Cuban Revolution took place, it didn't take place in a classical way. It took the form of a guerrilla war. And although the working class did play a role right at the end in Havana, there was a general strike which finished off the Batista regime. But you see, what people don't realize, Fidel Castro did not have the perspective of a socialist revolution in Cuba. I don't know if you know that. Fidel Castro's model, do you know what his model was? You'd be surprised, the United States. He wanted a bourgeois democracy. He had no conception of nationalizing anything. But Trotsky pointed out in advance, in relation to Russia, arguing against the Mensheviks. They had that idea, you know, two stages. First of all, a democratic state, and sometime in the distant future, maybe the workers could take power. Trotsky said no. What Trotsky said, this is a brilliant idea. Trotsky explained that under modern conditions, the traditional tasks of the bourgeois democratic revolution, I hope I'm not being too technical here, the tasks of the bourgeois democratic revolution was what was carried out in France after 1789. You know, an agrarian reform and the abolition of the monarchy and democracy and things of that, and modernization, things of that kind. That's what we call the bourgeois democratic revolution. Trotsky explained that under modern conditions, it's not possible to carry out that program under capitalism. The bourgeoisie can't do this. The bourgeoisie will play a counter-revolutionary role. Castro originally had the idea of a bourgeois democratic revolution. His model was the United States. I mean, I remember now, Harry will remember also, you know, pictures, there was a famous picture in the cover of Time magazine of Fidel Castro in America playing baseball. He was quite popular in America at the time. But the point is this, under modern conditions, the bourgeoisie is counter-revolutionary, and they immediately tried to attack the big monopolies, big American monopolies in Cuba, tried to attack Fidel Castro, tried to sabotage the revolution. They called him a communist and so on. To cut a long story short, at least Castro had the courage of his convictions. He said, well, I'm not having this. You're nationalizing, expropriated the lot. And then he turned towards Russia and so on. So in a sense, you could say that they carried out the permanent revolution in a distorted way, in a peculiar manner. What's the difference? Well, the difference is that whereas in Russia, that was the classical example of the permanent revolution, The Russian working class was in the leadership of the revolution, and it started off at least as a democratic worker state. Whereas Cuba, unfortunately, to some extent, copied the image of Stalinist Russia, although it wasn't as bad as that. It was freer than that. But here's an interesting point, which perhaps most people in this room will not know. I know a friend of mine in Cuba. Well, actually, it's the father and son. The father must be about 90 years of age now. Were Cuban Trotskyists, and his son, Leon, imagine why he's called Leon, who participated in the guerrilla struggle with Castro, worked with Che Guevara in the Ministry of Industry, I think it was, and discussed Trotsky at some length with Che Guevara. Che Guevara didn't know anything about Trotsky. They had long discussions. And as a result of that, Che actually began to read Trotsky, and he was quite impressed. To the extent, and you'll find this in his Bolivian diaries, that when he was killed, he actually had Trotsky's books with him. He had the Permanent Revolution with him, so that it was having an influence on him. And the he actually writes at one stage, he was crossing, by the way, a man that goes through the jungle in Bolivia with a heavy rucksack on his back and very few things, is very selective on what reading matter he takes with him, you know. And the history of the Russian Revolution is a very thick book. You'll find that the passage in the Bolivian diaries where he says, I lost my rucksack today in crossing a river, he said, and the thing I'm most sorry about is I've lost the history of the Russian Revolution in Trotsky's book. So it was having an effect. There's one little incident, interesting things you come across, you know. Leon was telling me that he was talking to Che Guevara, and Che says, well, you're talking about bureaucracy all the time. What's this about bureaucracy? Well, he didn't understand the concept of bureaucracy, so Leon explained what he was. He said, I think I know what you mean. So the next day they were working together in the sugar cane. They were cutting sugar cane. Everyone had to do this, including the top officials. And while they were working, Leon noticed there was a big black limousine was slowly crossing the field. He says, Comandante, I think you've got to visit this. What are you talking about? Look, you see this limousine? So Che Guevara says, just watch this. So this official gets out with his suit and tie. And Che Guevara says, what are you doing here? He says, well, I've got to... No, we don't want any bureaucrats here. Get out. He said, the chap went and he turned to Lee and he said, you see? He understood. No, I think it's now actually that the ideas of Trotsky are beginning to come into their own, particularly since the collapse of the Soviet Union. I mean, in the past, members of the Communist Party, the Stalinists, they wouldn't discuss with you. In some cases, they'd even beat you up. This has occurred. Not the case now. For example, I'm speaking next weekend in a meeting in France with the Communist Party. I took Stepan Volkov to the centre of the Communist Party in Paris, where they used to beat up Trotskyists. And there were old Stalinists sitting around, you know. And I was actually giving a talk on Venezuela, and Stepan was there. And I said, oh, by the way, we have a guest tonight. It's an interesting guest, the grandson of Leon Trotsky. And he got applause from the old Stalinists, you know. People begin to think, and they realize after the collapse of the Soviet Union, there's something badly wrong there. And therefore, the idea of Trotsky is now beginning to have an effect. I'll give you another case. In Venezuela, which I'm quite acquainted with the Venezuelan Revolution, I've had quite a few discussions with Hugo Chavez, and he has repeatedly mentioned Trotsky, and recommended Trotsky's writings and Lenin's writings, which he did recently. So, these ideas, I think, now are beginning to become more relevant than whatever they've been since 1940. So that's the long and short of it. So Lizzie asks, well, it says, well, there's many, it's a logical question, there's many groups on the left that call themselves Trotskyists. What's the difference with socialist appeal? Well, I would argue there are three fundamental things which distinguish this tendency. First of all, a very serious attitude towards theory. That's the first point. I would argue that it was only Ted Grant that really developed the ideas of Trotsky after he died. He made a serious contribution, didn't just repeat them, as other people do. So a serious attitude towards theory, as you see in the meeting today. But the other decisive point, theory is all very well, but you must link that, I think Sean made that point very, very well. You must link that to the real movement of the working class. I mean, if you want to join a revolutionary group of Trotsky, you're spoiled for choice. It's a bewildering choice. You go to any demonstration, you don't have a problem. Yes, but you see, we're talking here about mass revolutionary parties, as Ted used to say. Mass revolutionary parties are three men and a dog, which is not much use, you know. We have to link...
Your watch is going.
My watch is going?
Yeah.
Why is my watch going? What are you doing with my watch? you terrible man. It's the only watch I've got.
I don't know.
It shows it works, by the way. I don't know where it's going. It's probably reflecting some other time zone. I don't know. You put me off my stroke, man. You're supposed to be sharing this meeting. Trotsky made the following point. You see, to build, people talk about the Revolutionary Party, and you've got the SWP, and you've got other groups, and Uncle Tommy Cobbley and all. We've got to build the Revolutionary Party, we've got to build the Revolutionary Party. Very good. How do you do it? Well, I'll tell you what, it's a simple thing. You know it's a simple thing to build the Revolutionary Party? You know that, Harry? It's simplicity. Let's do it now. Let's do it now. Look. Against capitalism, hands up all those against capitalism, right? That's good. Against it is good. Labour Party's no good, yeah? Okay, all agree. Gordon Brown's a waste of time. Anyone favour Gordon Brown? Put your hand up, right? Nobody, fine. Trade union leaders are all a waste of space. Agree with this? Fine, okay. We understand. We are the boys. We are the boys and girls. So we proclaim ourselves, how many is here? There's about 20 or 30 people. It's great. So that's it. We proclaim ourselves. We are the Revolutionary Party. Problem solved. What do you think, Michael? Problem solved. Yes. Where's the problem? There's only one small problem. You might know that Gordon Brown is not up to much, and I might know that he's not up to much, but there's a few million workers that vote for him at election time. There's a small little detail, you see. And they vote for him not because they particularly like him, most of them don't like it, but because there's no alternative, as simple as that. There is no alternative. In Britain, in the year of our Lord, 2010, as far as the overwhelming mass of workers are concerned, there's no alternative to the Labour Party. If they don't vote Labour, they don't vote at all. And there have been numerous attempts by other groups to stand in elections, and they always lose their deposits. They make complete fools of themselves. The workers don't even notice such organisations. No. Our task is to work within the mass organisations of the working class. Okay? Same as the Bolsheviks did, even with Gapon's union. And these mass organisations, by the way, they will change. They don't live in the stratosphere, you know. They're under the pressure of the workers. All right, at the moment, there's no big movements of the workers in Britain. There will be, especially when Labour loses the next election, which I believe they will, because of the policies they simply deserve to lose, the way they're carrying on. But what's the alternative? The alternative is the Tories. Anyone knows that. And under these conditions, the Tories are going to stick the boot in. And if anybody thinks that the British workers and the unions are just going to sit back and allow this to happen, they get another thing coming. All hell will be let loose, first of all in the industrial front. But in Britain, the trade unions are linked to the Labour Party. And in opposition, the Labour Party can swing far to the left. I think Brown is finished, obviously. And a lot of the others will go, the Blairites will go, because their careers are not looking very rosy. And therefore, I believe there's a good platform for us, if we're patient. You don't shout and bawl as the other groups. You argue. What Lenin said in 1917. What was Lenin's slogan in 1917? Patiently explain. Patiently explain to the workers in the unions and establish a dialogue. Of course, we fight the common class. We fight against the Tories and so on and so forth. But at the same time, we explain that the working class and the labour movement must stand, shall we say, on genuine socialist policies. If you don't like the word Marxism, we're not going to argue about words and so on. So, the other thing, of course, is that we're internationalists. You know, we can't have socialism in one country, and you can't build a serious Marxist organization in one country. Marx, Engels, Lenin, Trotsky, Marx would never build a German party. And Lenin never built a Russian party. The very idea would be anathema. From the very beginning, from the days of the First International, Marxism always builds an international organization. That's why it's good that it comes from different countries. you know, what Marx said. Workers of the world, unite. We're against all forms of racism and chauvinism and nationalism. We're internationalists. Working class internationally has got one common enemy, which is capitalism and imperialism. And we stand for the sacred unity of the workers, irrespective of race, religion, anything else, gender, anything else. We stand for the unity. And therefore, that's why we have an international organization, the International Marxist Tendency, which is present in about 30 or 40 countries at the present time. And that's the correct way to proceed. What next? Tanya, where's Tanya? There we are. Very interesting question that, Tanya. Now, you see, when Trotsky opened up a struggle against Stalin, against Stalinism, he was in a very difficult position. For objective reasons. You know, you read these cleverest stories. By the way, they're all, it's terrible rubbish. Most of them write rubbish. Who's that clown in Cambridge? Orlando Figgs or Fids? How do you pronounce his name? He's not a friend of yours? No, I thought he was. Orlando Figgs, is it? He wrote a damn great big book like this. I ploughed through it. You know. It put years on me, honestly. It took years off my life reading that stuff. It's nonsense. And this idea, some other comrade raised that question. Oh, it's a coup. That's what it is. Not a revolution, it was a coup. Yes, analyze, you heard that argument. Oh yes, it was a coup of a tiny, unrepresentative minority. Lenin and Trotsky, a small group of conspirators, and they staged a coup and they took over the revolution. Now here's an interesting point, you know. You know one assumes, we are born with this thing on our shoulders, you know, in order to give us the capacity to reflect and think logically. That was always my understanding anyway, you know. Trotsky said one time, when all else is lost and you have no alternative, start to think. It's not a bad piece of advice. Think about it. Oh, it's a coup of a small... Now, hang on a sec. Wait a minute, girls and boys. Just a minute. Just hold your horses. You are talking here about a massive country of 150 million people, okay? By what art of black magic does a tiny minority of conspirators suddenly manage to control a country of 150 million people? Strange. What's the mechanism? How is it done? I wish somebody would tell me. I'd have a go myself. You know, it wouldn't be a bad thing. I'd go to a country of 150 million and take over like that. You know, it's just balderdash. We leave the realm of logic altogether. You get into the realm of mysticism and demonology, you know. The only reason why Lenin and Trotsky succeeded in taking power is that they actually succeeded by patiently working in the Soviets. They got the majority. Simple fact. They got, through voting, through the democratic procedures and voting and discussion, through the experience of the workers, because workers in general only learn from experience, they got the majority. Is that left or gone?
Gone.
Good.
You've been speaking.
Good. Okay. Right. Okay. That's relatively clear. So, they won the majority. In one Soviet, the Soviets, of course, were the elected councils of workers and so on. They hardly overwhelmed. That's why there was no resistance. Even that clown Figures. You may quote me if you ever come across this chap. You get expelled, of course. But you tell, even Figures says, he contradicts himself. He says that the Bolshevik coup in Petrograd was really a police operation, like a police operation. In other words, there was no bloodshed. A police operation is a simple matter. Just go to somebody's house and say, you're under arrest, come with me. You know, hand on shoulder kind of thing. You know, a police operation, that's correct. It was like a police operation. He contradicts himself. But how is it possible? You know, it was only possible, and if you read Jean Reed's book, it comes across very, very clearly, and it comes across very clearly also in Trotsky's History of the Russian Revolution. The Bolsheviks won a majority, and that's what enabled them to take power and nothing else. Oh, just one sort of side before we come back to Tanya. I haven't forgotten about you. But David asked the question, Trotsky on money. Well, Trotsky's idea of money, David, is the same as Marx, you know. That the capitalist society, of course, is based upon production for profit. whether socialism is based upon production for needs. It was a planned economy, you know. So Trotsky didn't have a different position to Marx in relation to that question. That's a separate discussion again. We'd have to have another session on that. To come back to Tanya, now that's an interesting point. When the revolution ebbed, you see there's a revolution, of course, the masses, it's got a period of ascent. You see this in the French Revolution also. A period of ascent in which the masses are on the advance and are actively participating. So then there can be a period of ebbing, of descent, in which the masses lose interest, they become apathetic, they become tired, exhausted, and so on and so forth. In that stage, then that was the stage Trotsky faced after 1924, after Lenin's death. Now, but I don't feel discriminated, Tanya, I'll come back to you in a minute, because this is related to Mikhail's question, you know. Why did Trotsky not use the Red Army to stop Stalin? I think that's what you asked, yeah? In 1925, he could have done that. Up to 1925, Trotsky was still the head of the Red Army. He had, of course, a colossal support in the Red Army. He had colossal support in society, which Stalin did not. Stalin was virtually unknown at that stage. Now, many people have asked that question, you know. Why didn't he do this? And the reason is that Trotsky answers that. The reason is this. You see, it's not as simple as that. All these historians are very, very superficial because they pose it as a struggle between two men, Stalin and Trotsky. And Trotsky, of course, was very brilliant and so on, but Stalin was even more brilliant. And Stalin was clever and tactically superior, and therefore he defeated Trotsky. Not so. The real reason was this. Instead, let me make a point to you. Trotsky knew that he would be defeated. He knew perfectly well that he couldn't succeed. What he was trying to do was to put down a marker for the future. The reason that he couldn't succeed, unless there was support from outside, from the world revolution, was the exhaustion of the working class. As I say, the workers would say, well, yes, we agree with your ideas. What you say is true about the bureaucracy and so on, but I'm tired, okay? I've got a family to feed, and I'm sorry, you know. That was the position. Therefore, he knew that they couldn't succeed. Now, why didn't he use the Red Army? Well, Trotsky answered that in the following way. He said, yes, I could have done that. I could have taken power in 1924 quite easily. But in that case, the objective conditions would just be the same. All that would happen is that I would be the prisoner of the military bureaucracy then, you know, the army generals. Instead of a civilian bureaucracy under Stalin, they'd have had an army, a military bureaucracy. And one of two things would happen. Either I would do what they say, you'd have the same corruption and dictatorship and so on, or else I'd have been removed. And far from combating the problem, you'd have had a Stalinist dictatorship in 1925 of a military character. And the reason I say that is that what we're discussing is not precisely a struggle between two individuals, but it's a class question. It's a question of the correlation of class forces, which was unfavourable to the working class. Trotsky had quite a small base to proceed from. Now I'll come back yet again to Tanya. Sorry about this. It's just that these questions are related. Now, being in a weak position, Trotsky started the opposition in 1923. That was the first opposition. It was a very small group of cadres of the party. At that stage, Kamenev and Zinoviev, who were two old Bolshevik leaders, were with Stalin. As a matter of fact, it's not generally realized, the person that started this nonsense about Trotskyism doesn't exist. They invented this word, Trotskyism. The person that did that was Zinoviev, actually, for personal reasons. People think that personal factors don't play a role in politics. I'm telling you, they do. Prestige. Zinoviev was jealous, as petty as that. Zinoviev was jealous of Trotsky because he thought, well, I've been with Lenin for many years. I should be the boss. I should be in charge. I'm Lenin's natural heir. Who's this guy Trotsky? And so he was jealous, as simple as that. And launched a scurrilous attack against Trotsky. Particularly after Lenin's death, they produced a little book called The Errors of Trotskyism. It was the first time that the word Trotskyism was used. And he, unfortunately, had the support of Lenin's widow, of Krupskaya. She was a personal friend, actually. They all ganged up, Zinoviev, Kamenev, Stalin, Krupskaya, the Errors of Trotskyism. He started this nonsense. It's an obvious, actually, Stalin was in a secondary position. Nobody knew Stalin. He was in a secondary position. It was an obvious making all the money. But of course, Stalin eventually took over because he controlled the party apparatus. And he started, the split came in 1926 when Stalin for the first time put forward the argument of socialism in one country. Never mind that world revolution, never mind about Germany, forget about all that. Socialism in Russia alone, socialism in... Zinoviev and Kamenev took fright at that, they became... they panicked. They broke with Stalin, they realised that things were going too far. They broke with Stalin, and the question was posed of a bloc with Trotsky. Now, many people in the Trotskyist camp were not in favour of this. So how can you form a bloc with this man, with this Zinoviev, with all his record and so on? And Trotsky answered in the following way. He said, well, oh, by the way, it's true that Zinoviev put conditions. You see, when you enter a political bloc, let's say that we form a bloc in the Labour Party, say, with left reformers, they might object to part of our programme, and you might have to retreat. You might say, well, okay, for the sake of unity, for the sake of the common fight against the right, we will have to drop point number B or C. It might be necessary to do that kind of compromise. It's possible. And Zinoviev objected to the theory of permanent revolution. I think it was, again, vanity on his part because of his role in 1917 and the rest of it. And Trotsky eventually reluctantly agreed to this. He agreed to not include it in the program. Some of his followers objected to this, and Trotsky replied in the following. He said, now look, it's true that it's not a good thing that we make this concession, but it's necessary to do that to reach several thousand workers in Leningrad. Zinoviev was in charge of the party in Leningrad, and Trotsky was hopeful that they would win over the proletariat of Leningrad. He was prepared to make that sacrifice. Although, he stood by the permanent revolution, but it didn't figure in the joint program. Of course, the answer is that bloc broke down quite quickly. Because Zinoviev's base was not secured in Leningrad. He controlled it bureaucratically, actually, same as Stalin. And therefore Stalin removed him bureaucratically. So that and then subsequently he capitulated to Stalin. Zinoviev and Kamenev were both very, very unstable politically. Very unstable. They capitulated to Stalin, so that was the end of that. So that the... Trotsky never abandoned the theory of permanent revolution. That was a tactical question for the sake of unity with Zinoviev, which didn't last. Incidentally, one small observation here. Stalin actually, he was also a complete opportunist. And he took over the program of the left opposition after expelling Trotsky. He took over the idea of Trotsky, for example, 5-year plans, collectivization. He gave it a hooligan and bureaucratic content. But many people were fooled by that. Many oppositionists capitulated, went back to Stalin, including Kamenev and Zinoviev and Radek. Trotsky did not. Trotsky made firm. He says, no, we're not accepting this. Precisely because he was defending, although he knew that they would be defeated and so on, but he wanted to defend the ideas at all costs. One question. How many people in this room have ever read anything about Zinoviev? Show of hands. One. You know, how many things have you read about Zinoviev, Rob? One. I've read two. I beat you two. There's nothing. And how was it?
Pretty poor.
Very poor.
Oh, two, actually.
Ah, well.
Ah, same as you.
All right, then, same as you. Okay. I'll accept the draw game. Very poor. You know, how many people have read something by Kamenev? Nobody. I might have read the odd article, I can't remember. There's nothing there. And even Bukharin had one or two interesting things, probably something. Lenin did say that he was one of the party theoreticians. Although, to be honest with you, Lenin also said that he was very abstract, very academic, very undialectical, and that's true if you read Bukharin's stuff. It's not as profound as the writings of Trotsky and Lenin. Really speaking, the only two worthwhile theoreticians in the Bolshevik Party was Lenin and Trotsky. And today, therefore, we can say, well, Trotsky's ideas still are absolutely relevant and absolutely correct. But who remembers Zinoviev? Who remembers Kamenev? If it comes to that, who remembers Bukharin? Or Stalin? It's only Trotsky's works that, and it's true, if you read them, and I urge all comments, please don't accept my word. Don't accept anything that I've said here today. Find out for yourselves, please. By the way, don't read books about Trotsky. Don't read books about Marx. Read Trotsky and Marx. You'll find it very easy. It's not difficult at all. And you make up your, you will find that there's an enormous profundity of thought there, which is very, very useful. Now, what else have we got here? Service. There's a whole industry, actually. It's a very profitable industry. If you want to make money these days, don't bother with banks. Write nasty books about Lenin and Trotsky. You make a couple of, all the universities will buy them, and that's a lot of money. You know? So it's disgusting, actually. It's completely disgusting. And just to finish, you see, Trotsky once said, Trotsky was subjected to the most monstrous slanders during his lifetime. I don't think anyone was, any individual has been so viciously slandered and insulted and day after day after day in the press of the world, you know. Very difficult to answer that, although he did. He did that. But Trotsky said the following, it's a marvellous expression. The locomotive of history is truth, not lies. The locomotive of history is truth, and the truth eventually will prevail. And that's the position now. 70 years after this cowardly agent of Stalin, this assassin, drove an ice pick through that marvellous brain, 70 years later, we still can find enormous, it's not a question of, not a moral question, saying, oh, well, a great example to follow. That's not the point. It's in the writings that you find the whole man. And these writings are very powerful weapons, the same as the writings of Lenin, of Marx. You know, I mean, frankly, you asked about money, you see. It's quite amusing. We're entitled to a bit of a laugh occasionally, you know. We must have a good laugh occasionally. This crisis of capitalism, you know, the collapse of the banks and all the rest of it, none of the bourgeois economists predicted that. They said the opposite. They said it wasn't going to occur. And some, I've been reading some of the bourgeois orthodox economists lately, and one of them actually said, a prominent economist, I can't remember his name, it doesn't matter, prominent American economist, says, well, the truth of the matter is, for the last 30 years, all of the predictions of the economists have been, in the best of cases, useless, and in the worst, positively harmful. And this is a key economist. You know, in Germany at the present time, 20 years after the collapse of the Berlin Wall, you know what's the best seller in German bookshops? Let me surprise you, Marx's Capital. Marx has come back to haunt them. Why? Because they find no explanation for this crisis in the writings of the official economists, and they will find, of course, a very serious, a very thorough explanation in the writings of Karl Marx. So I make no apology. Very delighted to come in. We'll speak again on other matters which you've raised, go into them in greater detail. But what I would say is this, I repeat, don't accept, don't take as good coin either the writings of Service or what Alan Woods has just said. No. Make your own mind up. But the only way you can make your mind up about Marxism is to read Marx and read Lenin and read Trotsky, and I guarantee you'll find it an enormously rewarding experience. Not difficult. And you will find, sure, many profound insights into the world, not the world of 1940 or 1848 or 1917, no, the world now. Very, very, very profound insights which help us to understand. And of course, our task is to change the world, that's true. But in order to change it, first of all, you have to understand it. And that's the great contribution, not just of Trotsky, but the other great Marxist thinkers of the past, that they provide us with a powerful analytical tool which help us to understand the world in order to correct and change it.